Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Welcome to Factor Theory Live. Excuse me. It is 6:03. It is December 29th. And that was a killer band called Judas Priest, Electric Eye. It's been really trippy. I've been listening to the other shows on the network a lot the last couple of days especially. And everybody has got theories, because that's pretty much all we can have is theories, thesis, and about what's going on. Especially a lot of people are starting to wake up now and realize there's something going on. It seems to be that this could be a place that was actually created by Lucifer, and we're in a pocket dimension that was created by Lucifer. That's the only thing that makes sense as to the lunacy that we're seeing in this day and age. And it's been making me wonder about the supernatural. And me and Mr. Rowe's here with us tonight as well. We had been talking before about ghosts, and Rowe has some stuff he's going to be showing me. And our other guest, Robert Morningstar, is here with us as well. How's it going, Robert?
Oh, it's going well. I'm happy to be here. Happy to be with you and Mr. Rowe.
Nice. Fantastic. Yeah, and you were telling me some trippy stuff about your experiences. So lucky for me, I've had head injuries and my memory is not so great. So I remember some highlights, but I would love it if you could get into the first paranormal story that you were telling me that you had when we talked on Christmas.
I think we went through several. Would it have been one of my...
I think it was maybe 81, the one you were talking about in 81.
Oh, the ghost experience. That was a life-altering experience, yes. I had a near-death experience on the day that Ronald Reagan was shot, and a ghost came out of a wall at Oberlin College, where I was teaching in the East Asian Studies Department as a visiting lecturer from New York. And Reagan had been shot, and I was lying in bed. I always sleep naked, if I can, if it's not 2 degrees below zero like it was last weekend. And so I just pulled up the sheets over myself, and my peripheral vision saw something, and there was an emanation out of a wall, a white figure, a figure in white from head to foot, white robe with a white cincture, a white headdress, and a shroud over the face, like a funeral shroud. And it walked across the room really, really in slow motion, giving me a lot of time to get myself ready. And I had a train of thoughts as this being was approaching me. And the first thing I thought, from his bearing and the the power that emanated from it. I said, this is the most powerful person that's ever walked the earth. And as he got closer and closer, foot by footstep by footstep, really slow motion, I said to myself, because my consciousness was split into fragments of identity, and I said, he knows I'm scared, but he's trying to approach me in a way as not to frighten me. He knows I'm scared. He's approaching me with a Tai Chi walk. For those of you who don't know, I've been practicing Tai Chi for 50 years and have been teaching it for the last 45.
You're essentially a master at it, correct?
Yes, I have been acknowledged as a Tai Chi master by the Hong Kong Tai Chi Masters Association. And actually the highest ranking masters of China acknowledged me in 1986. So my life is really tied up with Tai Chi and spirituality and spiritualism. This is what we're talking about right now, spiritualism. The mm-hmm. ability to contact and be contacted by souls, spirits, interdimensional beings. For me, they are all extraterrestrials. No, aliens, demons, djinns, ghosts, fairies, spooks, whatever. So as this being is approaching me, my body is going into panic and losing body heat. And he's coming closer and closer with this steady, steady gliding pace. Comes across the foot of my bed, and now my heart is racing. It's about to explode out of my chest. So as he was approaching me, I thought back to 7 years before, again, to bring you up on my background spiritual training. I was basically adopted by a Tai Chi master and a grandmaster and invited to teach Tai Chi. And when the grandmaster died, his ghost came to see me, and he frightened me then. It really is an otherworldly experience. Mm-hmm. But when I became frightened then, he said to me, don't be afraid, Robert. Nothing can harm you. And I accepted that as an affirmation that I have divine protection at that moment. Was being protected and nothing to fear. So I seized on that. And I actually went back to that moment, and I felt all the love that I had felt at that moment. And that spirit came. It was really full of love and radiant, universal love. So I started saying to this ghost, I love you, but I don't want to see your face. That became my mantra. I love you. Don't want to see your face. I love you, but I don't want to see you. And as he had, and I was crying. I mean, my voice would have sounded very meek at the moment, which I was. Just bearing the magnitude of such an event in my life, and with me wide awake. I mean, this is not dream. This is not sleep. This is not remote viewing, lucid dreaming. This is wide awake, crystal conscious reality. So he's coming across the foot of my bed, and my body goes into another state of terror. As he walked across the foot of my bed, I noticed my heart wanted to explode out of my chest. And I looked down at my chest, heaving, almost exploding. And I said, my God, it's as if I have a shell of concrete keeping my heart in my chest. Otherwise, it'd just explode or run out of the room. Turns the foot of my bed, and I said, this is death. This is death. This is why they find people asleep dead in the morning and say, oh, he died in his sleep.
Right.
Yeah, that's why. So, and then he's coming closer, and then I had a series of thoughts. Like, wow, this is antimatter. You know, what's he made of, right? It's getting really close. He's really not quite concrete, but he's really there. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So my physical, scientific mind tries to make an explanation. I said, God, this is antimatter. He's made of antimatter. And unbelievably cold. I felt as if I had been taken naked as I was and thrown out into Antarctica, you know, in winter. My life force was just being sucked out of me. And he comes over and stands on my right side, right next to me in my bed, looming over me, white from head to foot. And the shroud. And he starts to bend over, and I thought that he was going to lift the veil. And I said to him, please, I'm really strong, but please, don't lift the veil. I don't think I can take it. If you lift the veil, I'm sure I'm going to die. Please don't lift the veil. So what he did is he pressed the veil against his throat or against his face. And as he leaned over, I could see through it. And I saw the most powerful face that I've ever seen. And he came almost nose to nose. If you put your hand three, four inches away from your nose, that's how close he came, facing me, face to face, eyeball to eyeball. Although I could not see his eyes through the veil, I could feel them. And he said to me, "Behold my face, remember me." And I said to him, "Who are you? Who are you? Could you be the Christ? Could you be my soul? Could you be the soul of a Sufi master that I know?" Because he was dressed in white and I associated it with Islam, but it wasn't Islamic. And then he said again, and this time it was a different tone. He said, "Behold my face, remember me." The first utterance was a request. The second one was a command. It was imperative. And again I said, "Who are you? I know you. But I haven't seen you in so long." That's what I had said the first time after I said the three possibilities of his identity. "Who are you? I know you, but I haven't seen you in so long." So he gives me the command, "Behold my face, remember me." And I said again, "Who could you be?" Then he said to me, we don't want you speaking to people of what you know." And I was taken aback, said, "Me? Where are you coming from?" I'm wondering, is he threatening me? "Where are you coming from?" And he said, "Lucifer has taken over Islam and is going to use it as his vehicle to destroy mankind." And I thought, oh, I understand. When I thought, didn't utter it, but I said, "I understand." He just nodded a little bit and stood up, turned around, walked out, same steady, slow motion, methodical gait, turned the foot of my bed, and my legs were freaking out. And the parts of me that were closest to him were in utter terror. I could actually hear screams from each of my cells, my mortality, screaming.
That's terrible.
Yeah, and I looked down at my body and I thought, "I feel sorry for you." It was pitiful. And this is what I mean, that this experience fragmented my mind into mind, body, soul, and spirit. And body was just a craven mass of quivering jelly and rattling bones and internal screeches. And then the rest of us, got it together. And we held ourselves together by surrounding ourselves, me, myself, and I. When you ask about, people like to talk about preferred pronouns these days. So when people,
yeah.
I say me, myself, and I. So that was, and so it took 13 years to resolve this mystery of who this person was. And it led me on a quest for many, many years to understand how he could say that Lucifer had taken over Islam. But it became self-evident. This was March 30th, 1981, but over the next 10 years, it became self-evident that something malefic and horrific had taken over Islam. And through inciting hatred and terrorism, you know, that it was leading the world in a really terrible direction. So, ultimately, to make the long story short, it took me 14 years, to realize the identity of that person. And in the end, it turned out to be John F. Kennedy. The ghost of John F. Kennedy came to me on the night that Ronald Reagan was shot.
I was so outraged
to the deep state and tried to do it again after doing John and Martin, Robert, and the deep state once again tried it on Reagan. And I think that outrage brought him to me because I had a great filial affection for John F. Kennedy. that went on after his death. And what he showed me, the reason I couldn't recognize his face was he showed me his face with a peculiar expression. And the expression turned out to be the same expression on the single photograph of Officer Tippett that the public, the world, had seen in 33 years. And so they planted this vision, I guess you would call it, planted it in my subconscious with that unbelievable expression, kind of surly, kind of angry, very great. Not a happy
Revolution Radio.
And so by showing you the expression in his face with the expression that was on Tippett's face on his own photograph 13 years later, I found the photograph and began an investigation and realized, oh my God, all of those photographs of President Kennedy and Mark are not
Management
President
would like
Kennedy,
to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts
Officer
for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship.
His,
unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free.
Yeah.
We need the support of the
That's
people. It is the people like you.
That's why
yes,
I like to say that
you,
John F. Kennedy is the only man
who keeps the station
in
the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression.
And that's the God's honor.
Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems
Everyone
to be going deaf
reason,
to the real
and
truth. With your support,
mine.
You will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light.
Well, you got anything to say about
Revolution Radio for freedomslips.com?
Hey, Robert, how are you doing?
Radio station.
Oh, it's a thrill. A pleasure to hear your voice.
Revolution.
Thank you on the air for all the great work you do to keep my show going.
It's a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Hey,
thank
everyone.
You very
You're very
it's
welcome.
Barbara Jean
it's an
Lindsay,
honor.
The Cosmic Oracle.
Yeah, that's
if you have questions about your past
story.
Lives or
I mean,
future plans,
kind
need
of mind,
answers from the cosmos
actually.
About your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
The job is done. Last week I did a program with Richard Hoagland. Of all things, for Christmas Eve, he calls me up and he said, I got a great show for Christmas Eve. I said, what's that? He goes, well, you and I, just the two of us, we're going to do the John F. Kennedy assassination. I said, what? On Christmas Eve? He said, yes, it's going to be our gift to the country and the world. We're right. going to free them from the delusions. We're going to tell them the absolute truth. And that's the way I feel. It was a very good program. And it's probably running on his website, The Other Side of Midnight. Anyway, that's the God's honest truth, and I'm very happy to share it. You know, I kept the secret since 1981. I actually withdrew. This thing almost killed me, you know?
It
really rattled my whole life. I went into shock for quite a long time. And then, so I withdrew from public appearances and public lectures or... And I devoted myself to really understanding the roots of the world's major religions and how they intersected and how it came about that Luciferism could travel into Islam, out of Islam, into the Templars, into the Masons, out of the Masons, into the Sabbateans, into the Frankists, into the Catholic Church, into the United Nations, into the United States, and take over everything. As you said at the opening, I was quite surprised that you're speaking. It looks like we are in some pocket hologram created by Lucifer.
Pocket
dimension. That's what we're dismantling, you know, me by telling you this and Mr. Rowe. Mr. Rowe, I enjoyed your program on Tuesday immensely. I was listening to Feather. And then, you come on after, so I've sat in. I enjoyed that program very much.
Oh, thank you very much. Talking about the pocket dimension, if anybody's interested, there I did a show on April Fool's Day, April 1st, a reality extraction last year, 2021. And that was basically what I thought about how karma kind of works and reincarnation, and that it's possible, in my opinion, that this is the equivalent to a cosmic playground that the owner and caretaker has gone a little bit crazy and locked the playground up. And everybody that's inside the fake haunted house now is told the haunted house is real, and we all have amnesia. And the free universe is out there, and there's things going on out there that we should be part of. And what I believe is gone on a cosmic scale is we as creator beings created somehow in the cosmos a simulation where we could incarnate and experience, you know, all the feelings of flesh and blood and incarnation. And it was supposed to be kind of like a vacation or a holiday retreat, but something went terribly wrong. And the simulation got out of control and has locked its creators within.
Yes.
And so we are stuck in this, you know, a wheel of rebirth over and over. And there is a possibility to break out of this and go back to the free universe, which will ultimately happen because we are eternal beings anyway. But for the meantime, we're stuck in this birth cycle. And, yep. But if anybody's interested in me going in total depth of that and how I believe in how karma actually really works, because it's kind of a scam in this fraud universe that we're stuck in. April 1st of 2021, Reality Extraction. I talk about that, but that's my own personal opinion.
It's a valid opinion. And, you know, your description reminds me of what Edgar Cayce said about the entrapment of souls in the body. That it was kind of like a Disneyland for spirits, as you said, like Westworld. Come in and take a vacation, experience, and then go away. But Edgar Cayce said that they kept coming into incarnation and got, you know, harder and harder to extract themselves from it. Eventually, we got bound.
Yeah, you know, when you think about it, because the physical realm that we're in is a very, well, you could say it's very finite. It's very viscous in terms of, you know, the different realms that we experience. I've been having really vivid dreams, and you know, we have the astral realm that we can visit. But this stable, supposedly stable reality, maybe there's something to that. If we come back and we get too attached to this stable flesh physic reality, then it becomes easier to stay here and harder to, you know, ultimately escape in some fashion. I guess it's kind of like drinking too much or taking too much of an addictive drug, maybe.
That could be as well. There's this guy, he wrote a really trippy book about it. His name is Howard McCoskey. I'm going to try to get him on the show, but I want to play a little clip because this is getting right into what we're talking about right now. So I want to play a little clip from him. And his theories are very in sync with my own. This is about the AI realm that we're in.
So who is controlling things? You know, who did make this matrix of illusions?
This is my opinion, right? So this is, and it's always, everything I'm saying is a thesis, you know, can't 100% prove anything. It's all a thesis. And, but it seems now to me that the allegory that this is a realm. And in fact, I'll call whatever you want to call the creator of this realm, I'm going to call it more like a computer AI type of intelligence, because there is, and we can talk about all of these concepts of simulated realities and computer concepts of how reality seems to work. And again, I'm not saying it is a simulation. I'm not saying it is a computer, but I'm saying it's a good metaphor for our discussion, right? And what's interesting is, if you think of the vast, and when we talk about Plato's cave again, I'm not talking about the material realm. Plato's cave is this realm, the etheric realm, the astral realm, the angel realm, the super duper realm, the whatever realm you can think of where duality can, even the void. The void is even in Plato's cave. So it's a vast, and we don't know how many caves there are, how many material realms there are, how many, you know, universes there are within. There may be Plato's caves and Plato's caves and Plato's caves. That's a massive amount of power to generate, to run such a such a creation, it would make sense, and it would need a massive power source. It would make sense if you could find a way to, in a sense, have the characters of your video game generate the power that the game needs to keep running, so that you don't have to have any kind of exterior plug to ever plug in the, in a sense, the computer. The characters in the game, you might say, generate, they have experiences that you're able to pull the power out, put it back in your system, and keep it running. This leads to Robert Munro's ideas of louche, and in a sense that this is a type of farm to harvest energy. And to me, that makes sense. That, but it's not so much that I think the people will say, oh, Archons are eating the energy for themselves, and it's a power structure, and it kind of, but it's more, I think it's literally being put back in the system, because if the system runs out of power, just like your computer, if you run out of power, it'll just shut down. It ends. The simulation ends. So all of the beings who are part of the simulation, all the things that are, and that includes the potential of non-player characters, all the things that are in our realm that are not what you might call elements of the divine, elements of things outside of this creation, they need the simulation to keep running. So even though you might say this particular being is taking energy from whatever for itself, the system will still be taking the energy from that being too and putting it back into the computer and keeping it running. And I think one level, that's what we might be at now. You know, we're talking about the Great Reset. And the Great Reset can be, to me, it can be two different things. It can be one, a time loop, where we're coming to a particular end and we're literally going to loop back 100, 1,000, 500, whatever the time loop is, we're going to loop back, and that'll be the reset, because reset usually means going to zero somehow, right? The other way we can look at this is, oh, he's got something. Yeah.
Man, these Matrix things are crazy. I just interviewed the retired president of Monroe.
Wow, that does sound pretty.
Set in the Matrix. So, you ever heard the saying, art mimics reality and reality mimics art?
It's totally.
You know, something in there reminded me of what I said, that as this ghost was approaching me, I felt all my energy was being drawn out of me. And it's as if my energy was producing him, or he was sapping it. Interesting that Whitley Strieber, in his book Communion, touched on a very interesting subject. I thought it was a brilliant book, especially for this concept. He said, trying to explain this interaction with interdimensionals, he said, perhaps there is a technology on the other side of death that makes it possible for them to open a window into our reality, come and interact for a while, but they can't stay here and so must go back through the window. A technology on the other side of death. That was incredible. And I said to myself, well, what would you have on the other side of death but absolute cold? If life, you know, our bodies are hot, we're alive, what the first thing they do when they think a body is deceased, after checking for a pulse, is touch for temperature. If it's cold, it's dead. So perhaps coldness and super cold is part of the technology. And later on, I discovered the existence of something just called Beck, the Bose-Einstein condensate, which is this cloud of atoms that congeals and lines up perfectly north to south under certain conditions, but the conditions require very close to absolute zero in order to condense it, and then they keep it under control with a magnetic field. So I thought, oh, you know, these years later, I thought it was antimatter then, but it could have been Beck being created and controlled electromagnetically. What do you think of that, Mr. Rowe? Mr. Rowe, you have an amazing collection of ectoplasmic beings, shall I call them, orbs and ghosts and spirits, and that went through your apartment. And I saw the video that you and Stephen did. I must commend you. It's really, really well done. You want to talk about that? Because I think these two fields overlap.
Yeah, and let me also, you know, interject about, you know, communication with things on the other side. I'll tell you a story in a second, my own personal story, that's kind of helped make me what I am, I guess, in a way.
Actually, that's what I wanted to do, get a story from you, and then we can get into everything that Robert was just talking.
And And it's interesting because when I was working in the defense industry, in space and defense, there's some kind of a few interesting conversations I've had with some of the guys that would talk about, very vaguely, of course, other departments working on technological means to enter into other realms of existence, you know, whether it's enter to look into someone's dreams by putting something on their head or trying to actually work with, you know, old rites and technology to open up portals into other realms. But there was something that used to happen to me when I was a child, and it followed me around for years, is at night when I would go to sleep, I would wake up in the middle of the night, calmly walk out to my hallway, face the bathroom, which was right at the end of the hallway, and standing there in the doorway would be the shadow Hat Man. Sometimes just a silhouette of a tall shadow. Sometimes it would be like the silhouette of the tall shadow without like a fedora hat on. And I would be calm. I wouldn't be scared. And I'd stand there and it would come over and reach out to me and it would push me out of my body and I would fall backwards and I'd see myself standing there as I fell out of my body. And when I fell back down, I'd get to a certain point and then feel this pull and I'd go right snap back into my body again. The shadow would be gone and I would calmly go back to sleep. And this would happen for years until about when I entered puberty is when it stopped. And there was a negative experience with the shadow is after a friend of mine from Greece told me about his grandfather's book, this old book from Greece. And I always begged him to show it to me. And he would be like, it's at the house, blah, blah, blah. One time we were sitting in his driveway and I said, hey, the book, let me go get the book. I want to really see this. And he was like, so he finally decided, okay, you go and get it. He brings this book out. It's this big, thick, leather bound with weird symbols on it, book written in Greek. And he hands it to me and it was so cold. I remember the exact words I said. I said, would you take this out of the freezer? I mean, because it was that cold, like it was ice. I'm like, this is unnatural. And he's all, no, man, that's the book. And I'm like, okay. So I opened the book up and I'm looking at it. It's got interesting symbols and letters and things. And I'm, you know, not comprehending any of it. And then I start to feel a little bit woozy. So I didn't even attribute it to the book. I just thought I started feeling sick. So I gave it back to him. I said, okay, can you take me home? Yeah, okay, takes me home. I walk into my bedroom. It's really cold for some reason, unnaturally cold. The rest of the house was normal. I go I turn around to turn on the light because it was really dark. And as I turn around, right at eye level, just a few inches away, I see two red eyes staring at me. I mean, that was the most fear that I've ever felt in my life, bar none. And even until this day, I've never been more scared of anything. Just the feeling was there of fear. I dove for the light switch and the eyes were gone. But I mean, the room started to warm up after a few minutes. So I didn't sense that presence there anymore. It was just there for a split second. And later on, I kind of attributed maybe it was connected to this strange book. And I mean, I started to feel better and everything. Slept with the light on that night. But I've had a few of those interesting encounters, and those are just some of the more memorable ones. That was the most memorable, frightening, negative one I've ever had. And then, of course, the shadow thing would just follow me around. And I never knew what quite to make of it. Sometimes I think it was trying to teach me something, but I can't be sure if it was trying to push me out of my body so we could go in. I don't know.
Yeah. That's pretty wild, man.
But I didn't feel the fear from the shadow, so that's why I feel it was more of a guide or something. But
it's kind of like Dr. Strange, that movie. When they
I didn't catch that, Robert. Can you say?
I said every experience is a lesson in interdimensional communication with spirits, jinns. You know, it sounds like you had an encounter with a djinn, the red-eyed ones?
Yeah, probably.
They're evanescent creatures, beings. Sometimes they will manifest visually, but they are the ones that can actually, as you said, bump you out and step in. There's another, that's another experience. The experience of a walk-in, being a shaman, you know, you, you channel. And sometimes the spirits will attach themselves to you for one reason or another, usually for help, assistance in solving a problem that they didn't solve while they were alive. And that that can help a lot of people. And you can release spirits from the hold. Because my friend Paul Schroeder has a protocol. He's a very gifted psychic. He was an abductee at the age of 7 in Brooklyn. But he also has a lot of experiences with ghosts. So he wrote an essay called Ghost Rescue. And he said that when you encounter a ghost, you should try to help him. The first thing you should try to do is explain to him that he shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, you're not here. You know, you're dead. You don't belong here. I know you're not happy. Let's find a way to get you where you belong. And he's a very creative guy. And so we have to have open minds.
Mm-hmm.
If not,
well, especially when it comes to the spirits of children, you know, like Dave Schrader, we were talking about him too. He's going to be on next week. He does the show, The Holzer Files, and they have a psychic, Cindy Geza, and they're great. Like they, if they run into the spirit of a child, especially, they try to cross it over rather than just going, oh, wow, there's the spirit of a child there. They're hearing this thing cry. Dave starts crying on camera, and you can tell it's genuine. It's not just for the camera, because I started crying every time I hear a child on one of those EVPs, especially a baby crying, because that baby has no way of understanding. You know, it's just, it's trippy. And that's why it's going to be great to have Dave on next week. Yes. Still waiting to hear back from him. I want to, because I want to do a show with the two of you and Dave, and if possible, Cindy. I think that would be fantastic.
Well, I'd like to say that really this is the normal world. We're calling it paranormal just because the others can't perceive it. But I think that this is the natural state of consciousness. And that it's the gift that God gave us that we can transcend dimensions. You know, not only can we transcend atmospheres, we're the only creature that I know of on Earth, natural to Earth, that can subsist and exist underwater in the atmosphere and then go on into outer space. So I look upon my body as a spacesuit that my spirit is wearing so that I can operate here at this, on the surface of this planet, under an ocean of oxygen.
And, at this density.
Yeah, it's like a remote probe.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it attaches. And you know what? As long as we're talking metaphysics, my belief is that oxygen is the conscious agent in our bodies. That oxygen is conscious. And it wears our bodies like a diver wears a diving suit. And through our bodies, oxygen perceives through the different modalities of our senses. So
that's what,
my body.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, it's one of the elements that are composed of with water, which is one of, you know, the basic elements. And it's also what we're made of. And then you have the work that has been done by, what was it, Emoji, I think was the guy's name, and how water has been found to possibly have some sort of consciousness, but it definitely has a memory. It's like an archive. And so can you imagine what the oceans must hold?
Mm-hmm. Water has a memory and it makes choices.
Yeah.
Which way to run. So it's a fascinating thing. And yes, we roll to the water, the living water. You know, what is it that gets into the water in the human body that makes that water conscious and the other water inert or less conscious? Those are the mysteries that we have to resolve.
And it makes sense with the vaccinations because we're made up of so much water, and water has these incredible properties. It also explains why they're sticking us with vaccinations to try to dilute that water so that we can't access the miracle or the magic or whatever you want to call it.
Right. I was talking about C.S. Lewis last night to a friend in Canada that I think the most important book he ever wrote was actually a book called Miracles. where it's a very short book where he argues that we are invested with miraculous powers and that we have to just assert them, that much of the fall of man involves the loss of divine consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that when that consciousness is sparked once again by faith in ourselves and in the cosmic Christ, that we are invested with the same powers to create miracles that he promised. He said, greater things than these will you do in my name. And so that his argument, C.S. Lewis' argument, is that when Christ did miracles, he broke the laws of nature. He broke the laws of the old creation, and he established new laws. And because God is just, when Christ asserted those powers, he was asserting them not just in changing the laws of the universe from the old universe to the new universe, but thereby investing all of humanity with the same powers. It's a brilliant little book and very important. When you believe you can do it, you can do it.
Yeah. I've always felt that way. So even I can remember even like just like 1977 and seeing Star Wars and them using the Force. That concept just, it wasn't amazing to me. It made sense. It was like, yeah, but why can't we still do that? Like, I was thinking that from the time I was first watching that movie. It's always, I can remember sitting there trying to mentally make a cup come to my hand all the time and stuff. It was like, I should be able to do this. I'm like seven, right? So it, that makes total sense that it is essentially the Force. There is, like, for simple terms, for people who don't want to go all New Age or whatever, that's essentially what it is. And even intuition and stuff like that, we're picking up on a little bit of the abilities, just a tip of the iceberg of the abilities, the things that we are truly capable of. It's insane.
Well, I think it's the natural order of the universe. And the biggest trick of Lucifer has been to make us doubt ourselves and to believe that he has any power to give. That's really, it reverses the entire design of the universe. If you go into metaphysics or theology or mythology, Lucifer is supposed to serve man, and that's his rebellion. He hates man for that reason. But that implies that man has much more power than he has. So the trick is that he appeals to people, luring them under the idea that he has some power to offer or some license to kill, to sin, to do evil. And that's a fallacy. So the idea is, you know, you have to tell Lucifer and Satan what to do. And you're not subject, we're not subject to evil spirits unless we open ourselves to them. So that's a very important thing to consider. So how has it happened is, you know, we're talking about who's in control. The moment you asked that question, I said to myself, an artificial intelligence is in control. And that is the embodiment of Lucifer.
Right, folks, sorry about that. Steve Crawford here. Just as I was about to pause that video to say, hey, if I drop my internet, I'll be right back. The damn thing dropped before I had a chance. What's going on is, of course, they want us to use the 5G now, right? I'm being a stubborn prick and I'm keeping it on 4G. So at least once a day, sometimes twice, they restart my modem on me. Just to screw me up. So anyway, I had managed to stop right where Robert was talking about Lucifer, and we're going to get back into it. So if it happens again, it'll only be 1 minute, then it'll restart. So thanks, guys.
Passion without any reason.
There we go.
And best example of intelligence without love is communism and Nazism. They took intelligence and logic to the nth degree. and committed the most heinous crimes in the names of reason and logic. So we have to be very careful about our own thinking. I often say to people, you know, a couple of times a day as you're ruminating through the day and thoughts are racing through your mind, stop and say to yourself, is this thought truly my own? Or am I parroting, echoing, or receiving a beam, putting this thought in my head? Same thing goes for
every day.
I
wonder that. Go ahead, Ro.
I think Robert was, what were you finishing up, Robert?
About how we have to manage our emotions and our thinking and really consider whether the thought in our heads is really our own. Because so much of it is the hive mind. I go into the New York subway system and there'll be 25 people in the subway car. And 23 of them will have these iPhones or smartphones. And it was pathetic. I was in a car and this one was 15 people. I make a point of counting how many are in and how many are. So there are 20 people in the car and 15 people had the phone. And I look at this baby in a stroller. And the baby had the phone.
Oh, no.
I said, I'm crying for this kid.
You know, I remember when I was in my commuting days when I used to take the BART train to San Francisco and I just have to sit there for an hour in the mornings. I would notice, because this was back in the 90s, I would notice everybody was reading a paper at that time. And I thought to myself, wow, nobody's communicating. They're all lost in the newspaper. Now, nobody's reading the newspaper. They all have their phones.
They were absorbing information, and now it's imagery with a lot of subliminal suggestion.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know what was a weird parallel is I was watching this video of the bad part of I think it was like Philadelphia or whatever, like a street view of driving through Philadelphia. And it shows all the unfortunate people, the junkies and homeless and just down on their luck people on the sides. And they were all fiddling with something. And it wasn't a phone. It was a lot of times it was drugs. But the parallels of just fiddling with something in your hands, whether it's like getting your shot of fentanyl or heroin or looking at your telephone, they were all entranced and engulfed in their own little world, doing their own little thing, oblivious to the world around them. Yeah. And I couldn't help but make the connection of, you know, they're two different things, but they're doing basically the same thing.
Well, it's the hijacking of consciousness that's occurring and the blinding, the literal blinding of the human race through iPhones. The human eye has a scope of 120 degrees. When you look straight out, straight ahead, and contemplate both your peripheral vision and your foveal vision, it's a 120-degree scope. When you go to foveal vision, normally it's 10 degrees of scope. But when you go down into the phone and the screen of the phone, you've reduced your visual perceptions to about 5% of your potential. And as I was saying on this program, my Tai Chi masters taught me to pay attention to peripheral vision because spiritual insight comes to us first. The first
mindfulness
sign, mindfulness of your peripheral vision and absorbing, receiving the information that peripheral vision is feeding you. Most people don't even know they have peripheral vision. And one of the ways they taught me, the Tai Chi masters taught me to perfect this skill. They told me, go to a party. And when you're in the party and you know you have 7, 8, 10 people there in the party, just look at a point opposite yourself, maybe a point on the wall, and just look at that point, but pay attention to everything else you're seeing. And I found that once I started using that technique, I could not only see all the conversations and interactions that were going, but I could also hear better than if I wasn't concentrating in that manner. So these are also ways of developing extrasensory skills. See, I got into parapsychology because of the idea of extrasensory perception. I felt I had it as a child growing up, and my family had it, and other people just were devoid of it. So I chose psychology specifically to go into the field of parapsychology. And so that's why I say that this is the real world, this world of interacting with each other and other carnal beings, you know, on life on Earth. But this capacity for interdimensional communications on many levels, from the celestial to the infernal and back. And we are incredibly gifted by nature and endowed with these powers, and we should use them.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about, I've heard what you just described as, described actually in a professional environment as meditation on the room. And when you enter a room, meditate on the room, like pick a spot or a potted plant or something and just, you know, take that in, but also take in everything around you, the smells, the senses, the sights, the sound, and you'd be surprised at what you notice. And then one way they used to kind of enforce that is they'd have a room set up and they'd say, go in the room, meditate on the room for a minute and then come back out. And then they'd quiz you, okay, what color was, you know, the picture on the wall? What did it have on it? Describe the picture on the wall. Describe the song that was playing on the radio or whatever it was. And then you'd go back and forth and do that until you could get to an acceptable level of meditating on the room or the environment.
Yes, that's fantastic mental training. I was just sitting here, I was thinking about it. When I was a singer in bands for the longest time, and people would comment on how I was always sitting alone. Like, we'd get off the stage for a break or something, and I would grab a drink, and then I would just sit there and essentially do, I'd be staring at the stage and sensing what's going on. Okay, that's the tough guy over there. Oh, that girl wants to kick that one's ass because she's got a crush on her boyfriend. And I'm just like assessing the situation of what's going on. That guy's about to start a fight at this table. And I would walk up, move my pregnant girlfriend out of the way, sit her down beside me just in time to see somebody come over and throw the table she was sitting at, yeah, and stuff like that. It's just, it's wild.
Well, we're all capable. It's insight. And it's, one of the blessings I've had is growing up in New York, you know, and understanding body language. It's the greatest laboratory for understanding world body language. They said if you go to 42nd Street, you can't stand there 15 minutes without finding somebody from any country you could imagine, you know. And every country and every nationality has a unique body language. The interesting thing about New York is that somehow all of those body languages have amalgamated, and New Yorkers have a what I would call a universal body language. New Yorkers can interact with almost anyone on the spot.
Robert, I got to ask you a question real quick.
Sure.
Since you're a New Yorker, do you know, and you mentioned 42nd Street, do you know of a hotel that used to be there? It's a kind of a flop house called the Elk.
No, I've never seen the Elk.
Okay. The reason I ask is it was like, it's closed now, but it was my first time I ever landed in New York. It was the first place I stayed.
Oh, really? It's probably
totally random.
It's probably still there in the edifice with a new facade and a different business running it.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And but yeah, it was a $50 a night flop house that I just needed for a night or two. And had a house centipede crawling out of the sewer in the middle of the night, and had to deal with that.
Fond memories of New York. No, I don't know. Let me think. You know what? You're sparking a memory, and I'm starting to see a sign in gold that was like script and would just say ELK. I'm starting to visualize it. Goes back a long way. Yeah, my memory banks are pretty deep, and I can, let me tell you about it. Whatever you said, it just sparked this, and I have to share it with you. In 1973, I was driving crosstown from the west side to the east side, a 66th Street crosstown. Central Park is in the middle of Manhattan, so it blocks the streets, and you can only cross at certain junctures, 66th Street, 79th Street, 86th Street, 96th Street. So I'm at 66th Street, which is where Tavern on the Green is in Sheep's Meadow. So I pull up to a red light, and I'm about the second or third car back. So the buildings on both sides are framing a piece of sky and Central Park and the east side skyline. So I'm just sitting there waiting for this light, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, without a sound, this craft that looked like a 727 Whisper Jet fuselage with no tail and no wings just came in just like I've just done my hand. I think I did that pretty well. It came in like this. And stopped right over Tavern on the Green. And this huge field, all of Central Park is before me and the skyline. And then it did this. And then it did this.
Oh, nice.
Wow. That's what it did. I perfected it, telling it over
for those who can't see, Robert had it coming closer to him and then screwing off.
Here's the important.
The commercials are starting.
It went to a 45-degree angle and stopped, nose down, as if it was an airplane was going to crash right into the ground. Then it flipped.
Remember where you're at, Robert. It's the bumpers are running right now. We'll be right back with Robert Morningstar and Mr. Rowe.
All right, that was part one. Forgive me for a second here. There it is. Here's part two. And we left off with Robert telling his UFO story.
All right, welcome back to Factor Theory Live. I'm Steve Crawford, and it is 7:03, December 29th, 2022, getting close to 2023, and I am here with a couple of really cool guys, Mr. Rowe, who is a host here at this station, as well as one of our more popular hosts here at the station, Mr. Robert D. Morningstar. And I'm going to bring up a little thing here about Robert. Okay, so this is on Graham's. Do you write for Graham Hancock's website there, Robert?
Occasionally. That was the first. That's the most important one I have written for him. We've been corresponding for about 25 years, and he invited me to write up an article for his website, and that's it. It's a very beautiful story. I waited 25 years to write that story. So.
Oh, that's wild. Just going to read a little bit about this for some people who don't know how accomplished Robert is. Robert D. Morningstar is a civilian intelligence analyst and psychotherapist in New York City. He is a specialist in photo interpretation, analysis, and computer imaging. He graduated from Power Memorial Academy in New York. Morningstar was a New York State Regents Scholar from 67 to 72 and received a degree in psychology from Fordham University. He's an expert in the Chinese language, history, and martial arts. He's acknowledged as a master of Yang family Tai Chi Chuan, okay, by the Hong Kong Tai Chi Masters Association, and has taught at Oberlin College for the City University of New York Country College, as well as the International Center for Disabled, and he is a licensed pilot and instrument ground instructor with 23 years flying experience. Okay, let's get into that for a minute.
that's an old bio.
Because there's way more that you could add. But let's get into the flying part now. Have you ever been, and I want to get back to your story. I remember you were in New York. You saw this thing coming back.
Right.
But while you were in the air, have you ever seen anything while you were in the air?
Yeah. I was passed by two egg-shaped UFOs back in 1990. I was doing a three-point cross-country for my license. I got it in 1990. And I was leaving MacArthur Airport in Long Island and heading west. And I was near Northport. And in Northport, there's a big power plant with some gigantic stacks. I mean, couple of hundred feet high, the smokestacks. So I'm approaching that, and I look to my left, and in the morning haze, it was about 11 o'clock in the morning. And in the morning haze, I saw two objects low at my 10 o'clock. So I called air traffic control to inform them, because in this area where I was flying, I was under direct air traffic control from MacArthur Airport. and it extends beyond the airport for a couple of miles. So anybody who flies there has to be in contact with them and have a transponder, which is basically your own self-generated radar signal that the airplane will put out. The signal, instead of waiting for the radar from the airport to hit the plane and bounce back, the right. airplane is sending out a signal, and it's got a tag and an identification code. So I'm under that positive control, as it's called. So I call up MacArthur Airport and I said, MacArthur Airport, Cessna such and such, Juliet Hotel is just south of Northport. I have some traffic at my 10 o'clock. And he said, well, we don't see it. You know, I got the word back, I'll take out the formalities. We don't see them on our radar screen. And they're rising, you know. And I'm doing two fingers like this for the people who can see it. We're going to have a video of this. So mm-hmm. I see two dots, white dots, rising, climbing steadily, evenly, uniform speed, and I'm going to intersect them. They're coming up, and they're going to cross my flight path. And so I just kept my eye on them. I told their traffic control that they were rising, and they were going to pass my nose. And when they passed my nose, the nose of my plane and my nose and my head, they went by straight across. I was crossing the T, and I'm doing my fingers like this to show you how uniform the two of them were in unison, and they just never separated. It looked to me like a glider when it tows another airplane. It's a steady right. distance yeah. because of the cable, but there was no cable. There were no wings. There was no props or jets, nothing except a teeny weeny little dome on each of them. And I couldn't figure out how anybody with a head like ours could stick his head out to look through the dome. Anyway, so I crossed the T on these two things, and they went on, and I went on, and I crossed. And here's the most remarkable thing architecturally or aerodynamically as a pilot that I can tell you. When they passed by me, they were egg-shaped, right? Oval-shaped. Mm-hmm. And when they passed by me, they went on. Over Long Island Sound, and so I crossed behind them, and I saw them by the tail, and they were the same oval shape from the tail as they were from the profile, which is really odd. And you know what I thought of? It was so beautiful. I thought of the hulls of two America's Cup yachts without the keels, laid one on the other, deck to deck. That's the right. ideal shape that I had, the beauty of an America's Cup yacht. The curvature of it, but without the keel. If you took two of them and put them deck to deck, it would give you an idea of the shape. So when they passed me, they accelerated and they took off, and they were heading in the direction of Bridgeport. And all these many years later, I guess the best way for me to describe them would be with the word tic-tac, the word used by the Navy pilot for what he saw.
That's wild.
And Fravor, Commander Fravor. Right. You describe them as tic-tacs. Well, I describe them as eggs or lozenges. They were rounded, absolutely beautiful. And air traffic control couldn't pick them up at all, even when they were right at my altitude and crossing. And they said, well, sometimes, you know, sometimes we don't pick up some of the traffic at lower altitudes. But they were at my altitude, and they crossed. After they passed me, I would say that they were passing me at about 200 miles an hour. You know, not really that fast. Pretty fast, but not that fast. And they crossed in front of my plane as I was closing on their flight path to within 150 feet. But I felt no turbulence. I had no problem with the engines. Nothing affected the electronics. And but when they passed me and we're over the Long Island Sound, they crossed Long Island Sound in 7 seconds. So it means they accelerated from about 200 miles an hour to about 1500. Right. Now here's the curious thing. When I lined up where I intercepted them, it was from Republic Airport with a beeline to Bridgeport. And what's at Bridgeport? Sikorsky Aviation. And I suspected that that might have been one of our secret projects, and that they were ferrying the craft from Republic Airport, where Grumman used to be headquartered. That was in Republic Airport. And beeline to Sikorsky Airport, which is where Sikorsky Aviation and Pratt & Whitney, all of them are in that area. It's a big military-industrial complex area.
Right.
But let me get back to the Central Park one that I was describing before. Because that one is super cool. So this time I'll use a remote control. It'll be in black. But it was a very psychic moment. The thing came in like this. Right? It stopped right over a place called Tavern on the Green. It stopped like that. Right over Tavern on the Green. Like, imagine a 727 airliner was going to crash nose first right into the earth at this angle and just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the restaurant is under here with the lights, Tavern on the Green.
Okay.
And then it went like this. Right? And then it went like this. Sideways. It came in nose first, tilted nose up, and then flew away sideways.
That's trippy.
Unbelievable. 2 seconds, and it was gone over the east side skyline. But here's the wild part. There were two windows in the front and two windows in the back. They were large rectangular windows with rounded corners.
Mm.
One set of windows was glaring with a brilliant blue light. The other set of windows was glaring with a brilliant amber light. The amber light was soothing, the blue light was glaring, and as it came in and stopped, I heard this voice say, "Don't look at the blue lights. Only just look at the amber lights." And that's what I did. I took my eyes off the blue lights and I looked at the amber lights. And as I looked at the amber lights, the craft went like this. Just like that. And gone. That's only one of many, many encounters, UFOs. I've had UFO encounters all my life. And it seems like I'm one of those groups of people, certain families are tagged.
That's
my first
insane to me.
Traumatic experience was with an alien encounter.
I've never seen anything that I can remember up close like that. At this point in time, I think I'd love to, and I wouldn't consider it an abduction if they took me either. They'd be saving me from this.
Yeah, true.
You know, like, wow. But how long? What was the entire duration of that incident?
Of this, the
Central Park. From you sitting there and seeing it come.
Okay, I'll show you. It was this long. About 7 seconds.
6 seconds, yeah.
Six seconds.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you got the feeling that if you perhaps had looked at the blue lights, you may have been abducted?
No, not at all. I just heard the voice tell me, don't look at the blue lights. Only look at the amber light, as if it was protecting me for something. Like,
right, and that's what I'm wondering. Is that some sort of choice we kind of have? And you were given, most people look at the blue and they get abducted, but something helped you out and said, no, turn this way. So you did, and then it took off. That's freaky.
Well, I have had several experiences, direct experiences, across... I'm 74 years old. That's a lot of time. But across my lifespan, I have had many experiences with extraterrestrials. But I was not free to speak about them publicly because of the stigma and, you know, Big Brother and all of those guys don't want to tell each other what's going on and how many races are going on. I've had encounters. I stopped an abduction of my girlfriend from my bedside in Fire Island in Labor Day of 1978. And I experienced the alien mind scan as I negotiated with this alien, like how to get the hell out of this situation.
Wait, okay, that's the story. Okay, actually, before we get into that story, that's the story I want to go to. But, Ro, do you have anything to add to what Robert's been talking about?
Well, it reminds me of, you know, one time when I was... with some friends, we went to the Gallery Tribes in New Mexico back in 1995 at Tres Piedras with the Rainbow Gathering there. And on our way, we're out in the New Mexico desert, and it just happened. I remember it was on June 29th. It just happened to be when the shuttle Atlantis was supposed to dock with the Russian Mir space station. And we said, hey, let's see if we can see it. And so we're out in the middle of the desert, and we saw the docking. We had, you know, some pretty good optical equipment. This was before I worked for TRW, which I shortly afterwards, I got a job with the space and defense industry where I saw all kinds of interesting things. But then after we watched this docking, there were three triangular craft that were, at first they were little points of light way up where the docking was. And then they came way down to where we could see that these things were some sort of triangular craft. They weren't really low, but they were low enough where you could, they were, those aren't airplanes. And they were doing maneuvers with each other. And then they would go far away and go back up near the Mir shuttle docking. And we sat there, and I remember specifically, I was with two other people, a girl and a guy. And I said, we're all each other's witnesses, right? We're watching this happen. I mean, we're just seeing these other things, because we knew that the shuttle was going to dock, but we didn't know what the heck these other craft were that were flying back and forth. And we figured they were some sort of military, our technology, but we couldn't be sure. I mean, so that's I remember
what
that one.
What year was that, dude?
1995. Now, I remember because we were going to the Rainbow Gathering, it was in Tres Piedras, New Mexico. And that's where the gathering was, and we were on our way.
I was at a movie with my ex-wife in Niagara Falls, looking towards that. Actually, we were looking in a different direction, but I saw exactly what you – it looked like take the Russians out of it. But there were several ships up there. Actually, I was thinking it was more like seven. But they were that high up, so they weren't up close. And the maneuvers they were doing were flipping me out.
Yeah.
We got back to our campsite. And I looked up, and they're still doing this. And I had a beer in my hand. So these girls are walking by, and I'm like, look up there. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? They looked at my beer and then just started laughing, thinking I was drunk, and wouldn't look up. And I'm like, somebody please look up. There's something trippy going on in the sky. It was freaking me out. And I think it was because I got chills when you just described that. I believe that happens to a lot of people.
And one other thing I'll say, because, you know, when I was living in Amsterdam, my friends ridiculed me. Because one day I was in an apartment staying with some folks, and I stood there looking at this pulsating object in the sky that was really low. And if you really looked at it, it's not a star. It's changing colors and possibly even changing shapes, like some sort of plasma, you know, pulsating thing. And I'm sitting there trying to point it out to people, and they're laughing at me like, dude, it's just a star. And I'm like, it's not a star. And of course, they're not interested. They're doing their own thing. And I'm like fascinated. And then I remember back, it was maybe 2010 or something. I was looking at trying to find out what it was on the internet, and somebody posted a video on YouTube called My Morning Star. Interestingly enough. Yes. And it was a video of that. And it was this woman in I guess she was in the UK somewhere, and she's like, oh, it comes every once in a while, and here it's back again. I wanted to show you, this is my morning star, and sometimes it goes away, but it always comes back. And that was like, oh, my goodness, that's it. And I don't know what it was. It was a big pulsing object of light. It would go red, blue, purple, or yellow, and then look like it'd get bigger and smaller. And it was low enough, like, where – if you were behind some buildings or something, you might not see it. It was that low on the horizon over Amsterdam for, I would say, for about a week, and then it was gone.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, and nobody would pay any attention to it when I'd say, look, it's still there. There it is. There, dude, it's a star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's the conditioning. That shows you the degree of mind control that was exercised on the Dutch to keep them out of our consciousness. They used every possible ridicule, persecution, fear-mongering.
Non-player characters.
Maybe it was projecting something that didn't work on me, and I'm like, I can see you.
Oh, you know, that is true. They shroud themselves.
Cloaking
certain people's vibrations. Certain people are allowed to see them.
Right.
Other people are not. The two people,
it could be three people standing there and only one will see them.
Yeah, but you know what? The same thing is true about rainbows. Think about this. The rainbow is in the sky, but it can only be perceived by people who are at about a 43-degree angle. I think it's that specific. It's 43 or 45. And the people who have that angle will see the rainbow, and people who are just a couple of feet off the angle will not see the rainbow. And I think UFOs exercise a similar effect on human perception. They can turn off some of our senses by sabotage. When one gets close to an extraterrestrial, the electrical field of the extraterrestrial will have effects on our neurology.
Like a scalar projection of some sort.
Right. They said, last night I was watching an amazing interview with a fellow named Steve Bouchard, who was a Canadian abductee, a contactee, I would call him.
He lives here in my city.
Oh, yeah. They mentioned St. Catharines in his interview
last night.
He's been on my
show. Yeah.
Well, that guy talked for about an hour and a half, and he gave more information than I've ever seen anybody give regarding his, not just his abduction, because it was kind of voluntary. They asked him to go along, and he said, you know, I don't feel I was abducted. I went along. But he gave so many details of the dialogue with the Greys that he had. Once when he was 4 years old, he and his father were taken. And then two more times at least during his adult lifetime, he was taken along with the band. You know, and I would recommend it. Steve Bouchard, B-O-U-C-H-A-R-D.
Was that on The Fifth Kind? Paul Wallace.
Yeah, that's the one. That's exactly. Yeah,
Paul's been on my show too. He's great as well. Excellent. You should check out his books if you haven't.
Well, I had my first traumatic experience at the age of three. I was living in the Deep South in my grandfather's house, and I was swinging on a bench swing that he had on his porch, and it was night. And there was a window and a room next to me in darkness, and the other side of the room there was a door that was open to a hallway that had light shining through it. So I'm sitting there, and I'm a totally happy, innocent, you know, normal baby. And 3.5 years old. I'm cognizant. I can go around by myself. I walk, I talk, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, again, peripheral vision. My peripheral vision picked up something. And it was best described as I saw something that was black within the black. For example, Stephen, you're sitting there in the darkness. Now, if something blacker than the black side of your screen came in and I saw that blackness and it started to walk across, I think caught my eye. Startled me, as a matter of fact. And I looked at it, and the way it walked was not human. Definitely not human. It was skulking, is the word. You know?
Right.
Hunched over, no neck. And it stopped. When it got into the doorway, it was silhouetted by the light. And I saw the whole outline of the creature. And at that moment, he was going across like this, looking at the other side of the room. And then he just stopped. And then he did this. Like that.
It's a boogeyman.
And he looked at me. Man, I screamed bloody murder. I mean, we had baby adrenaline. Baby adrenaline just, wah!
Yeah.
Everybody comes running. And like, what's the matter with it? Something in the room. They all run into the room. There's nothing in the room. And they come back and say, baby, you didn't see anything. You just, they can't say I had a nightmare because I was wide awake.
Right.
They couldn't even say that. But, oh, no, there was nothing in the room. And you know what? My baby logic said to me, no, there was something in the room. But he went right down through the floor and he's under the house right now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, when you
even when call it baby logic. Go ahead, Rose. Sorry.
When you're a child, coming, you know, children are the closest thing there is to recently from the creator. You know, they just come in from the beyond entering this realm. And so they're still in touch with a lot of things. Their senses still pick up things. And I remember a similar, this used to be repetitive as well. Now with the shadow person I saw, I didn't have any fear, but sometimes, and I remember a specific incident, it was like an afternoon. You know, like a Sunday afternoon or something, when it's real quiet in the house, it's daylight outside, and I was left in my mother's bedroom on her bed. I'm just sitting there. And out of the closet, literally walking out through the closet, through the walls, were these not silhouettes. They were gray forms. They didn't have any faces that I could, maybe they had eyes, I don't know, but they didn't have any clothes. It was all gray. And these things would just walk just normal. They would be like, just not like a human would walk, but real slow, sort of methodically walking, like they were in a daze or something. Mm-hmm. And it would be four, five, maybe six of these things. And they would walk out from the closet across the room, scaring the crap out of me. They wouldn't notice me though. And I would just be frozen in terror, panic, looking at these things. I'm like 3 or 4 years old, and they would just walk through the walls. And I would see these things would appear in different places, but always during like maybe the daytime or the early evening, which was a weird oxymoron to me now, because it was like I shouldn't be scared of these things that didn't notice me or interact with me in any way, but I was. But the shadow, which did interact with me, I wasn't afraid of. And so both of these incidences would repeat throughout my childhood. And I used to call them zombies. And I would be going to sleep at night. Please don't come. Please don't come. Please don't come.
Oh, really? Oh, it's sad. Yeah, that's terrifying.
Even to this day, I don't go to bed till 5 in the morning. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Robert.
Me too. I don't go to bed till 5 in the morning. Yeah. Waiting to show up at 3. You know, exactly. They say that people like us, you know, who have that habit, have had an experience that happened at a particular time, and we find it very difficult to sleep during those hours for anticipation,
exactly.
Visitation, and the desire to be the greeting party rather than the one that
I would be sitting there at my window. I was living in this small apartment by myself, basically a room with a bathroom and a small kitchen. And I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing this thing. Like, I lived in Niagara Falls, Ontario at the time, and it's over Thorold Stone Road. It looks like it's basically over the McDonald's there, which is about a 10-minute walk from where, actually maybe more like a 5-minute walk from where I am. And it just sat there all night. I even called the police station, and they said they don't know what it is, but they've been getting calls about it. And I remember, I think it was 2 days after that incident. I think it was maybe an hour it was there, and then it took off. And this was from 4 to 5 in the morning. And I was like, I'm not going to sleep because this thing's not getting me. And I'd stay up. As soon as the sun would come up, that's when I would crash. But a couple days later, I had a girlfriend staying over. She had gone to the bathroom. The only lights I had were Christmas lights around my ceiling to illuminate the room. Mm-hmm. And so she gets up, leaves the bed, and I open my eyes, and all I see is total blackness. And I can't move anything but my head. It feels like something's literally sitting on my chest with their legs over my arms or something. And so I'm trying to move my head, and I'm blinking my eyes, trying to get something, to be able to see something. And I hear a voice going, whoa, 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 hey, relax. I start being able to move my shoulders. All of a sudden, boom, the lights come on. I'm laying there. I can see the lights. My girlfriend comes back into the room and goes, were you just in the bathroom behind me? She was like, I couldn't move. It felt like there was something there. And I was like, holy crap. That was one incident. Mm-hmm. Shortly after that, years before I could go to sleep before 3 o'clock in the morning. And every once in a while now, what am I saying? Most of the time, it's 5 a.m. I finally laid down.
You know, for me, one of the issues when I was a child of sleeping was if I went to sleep on my stomach and my head was against the pillow to the point where I could hear or feel my heart beating, then things would come to, like, the heartbeat would act as some sort of, like, mechanism to draw something.
That's wild. I've never thought of that.
So I would make sure later on, and I used to chant a mantra to it, please don't come. Please. And sometimes, though, as I got older, it was weird because now I remember I would go, please come. Please come. I wanted them to come back.
As right.
When I was no longer afraid after a long enough time, and I was like, hey, you know, where are you guys at?
I've had similar reactions. It's very interesting that you mentioned this about the heartbeat, Mr. Rowe, because I've been teaching remote viewing courses online, webinars, month-long courses, since June. And in the work that I've been researching and teaching, it turns out that the CIA did a lot of work in remote viewing.
Yes.
And this interdimensional communication. And they found one of the theories that they came up with is that the heartbeat is creating a wave, and the wave passes, it propagates through the aorta. And when you're doing a certain, when you're in a relaxed state and doing a particular kind of breathing and meditation, the wave goes down and hits the femoral artery where it's blocked, not really blocked, but it's going into another narrower blood vessel, and that there's a wave that comes back. And that when this wave, the wave of the heartbeat pulsing down, encounters the other wave, and they get into a particular synchronization, mm-hmm. that's the condition under which the remote viewing can happen optimally, or psychic events and telepathy happen.
I think that's also an astral gate, that it allows easier, I call it traversing through the crowd. There's mm-hmm. this like feeling of a lot of people watching, even though you're not. When you project into that astral realm, mm-hmm. I think that rhythm helps facilitate, maybe that helps facilitate that as well. Maybe it has something to do with the heart chakra.
Well, breath control and controlling the rhythm of the heart, and resonance, getting your body, your mind, your soul, your spirit to start to resonate at a particular frequency and harmony is one of the keys to...
Cymatics.
Frequency.
Yes, cymatics is... You know, I think cymatics may be the answer to... maybe our bodies are standing waves, sound waves that are aggregating these molecules to keep our identity.
Well, if we're made of water... And vibrations like from frequencies affect water just natively, then imagine what they would do to the water that's combined with us, you know, like the electromagnetic fog and stuff. And it's possible that the right frequencies, the right harmonies, like from a cathode rail cathedral and a large pipe organ on 432 hertz projecting the right tones, might act as harmonics to heal us.
Yeah, and keep us young.
Yeah.
We use that 432 and 528 frequency in the meditations that we do to develop the remote viewing and lucid dreaming. Well, you know, the course that I taught really, wow, polished off my skills. And I started having just relentless series of premonitory visions, I would say, rather than dreams, because they were so vivid. And there was one night, it's just incredible. I like to sleep in the dark. So I wear a sleeping mask because
and earplugs.
Well, I want to hear what's approaching. When things go bump at night, I want to hear the bump before they get here. You know, so I sleep under a mask, and I'm in the middle of the second seminar webinar on remote viewing, and so I'm really at a high level of concentration and vibration. All of a sudden, out of the blackness, I see the most brilliant light imaginable appears, a white light appears. And it was just so bright that even in my trance, let's call it that, in my trance, I shielded, I put my hands over the mask and over my eyes and dropped my head because it was just so bright. That I said, you know, you're too bright. I said, you're too bright, you're hurting my eyes. And then I peeked for a moment between my fingers. I put down the mask and peeked between my fingers, and I saw it dim, and this incredible luminosity just dimmed itself and got small and turned into a white pearl UFO, a sphere, came down into my room, and it started to go around my bed like on a circuit, but it was being chased by five black pearls. Five black negative UFOs were chasing the bright white positive UFO as it was circling around my bed, and I think transmitting information to me, as the other You know, it was like the Star Wars scene where the TIE fighters are chasing the X-Wing destroy the star, the Death Star. Kind of like that kind of action. But the energy of the black things was impelling, was giving energy to the white things. So I think it was a very deep message in there. But the next scene was really interesting because it taught me a lesson. I saw that my bed was surrounded by water, and I saw a shark in the water, and I had to get out of my bed, so I had to go in the water. The shark attacked me, and I punched him in the nose, and he went off. And all of a sudden, I looked, and I had a black glove on. And then when he came the second time, I ran my hand down to pop him in the nose, but he bit my hand. And I could feel the tiger shark, but shark was biting the glove, but it wasn't penetrating. I said, the glove's got me. So I had him by the snout, and I said, the shark is going, like on my hand. And I said, yeah, the shark has me, but I have the shark too. So I said, what am I going to do? I'm going to drag this shark out of the water. So I dragged him. My hand is holding him. The glove's protecting me. I grab him by the snout. I turn, I do a judo throw, and I threw the shark out of the water onto the land, and he's flopping. I said, now I'm going to deal with you. And I woke up short. That was the third dream, but it's relentless, you know, the symbolism is relentless coming when you open up the well of the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious starts to speak to you.
Yeah.
And it uses these symbols from your own experience to try to get the message to you.
Robert, I wanted to ask you, did you have any opinion on what you thought of the ectoplasmic things that are around in my house?
I thought you had the best collection of orbs, ectoplasm, ghosts, and you know, Mr. Rowe, the most shocking one to me is the one, the emanation that comes out of the mirror. You know, it comes out of the top of the triangle frame in the mirror.
Yes.
Because as that thing shoots across the room, there's also a sound that's recorded. It's an aspiration. It's a breath of some sort. It goes.
Yeah, that's the one that it's like or something, and it.
Yeah, it goes shuzha. It's a breath. And the other one that I was telling Stephen about that just made me jump out of my seat is the one where the big thing, the body, I call it the body, drops out of the ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just
watching. Gigantic. It's a huge thing. But the thing I pointed out to Stephen was that I was listening to your radio in that clip, and I think the radio is describing a murder. In the background. The radio is describing a murder, and whoop, the body falls out of the ceiling.
It's a rippy ectoplasm-looking thing.
Yeah, it made me feel like I jumped out of my skin. That's the expression. I'm watching all the other videos of the orbs exploring your apartment and coming up slowly over the chair and, you know, doing all of those and extremely unusual ones. But when the phantom dropped out of the ceiling, I jumped out of my skin. I said, whoa. My seat was lifted out of my chair and reminded me of.
These are activated in the infrared spectrum. Yeah. And the motion detector brings them up. You know, the only other thing that I remember, well, there was it's the turn of the century, there's something called Dysonin and dye, and it was used to create this filter that filters out certain spectrums of light. Mm-hmm. And it was used to train people to kind of see auric emanations and things that weren't there. And then back in, let's say, the 70s, when they were first perfecting night vision, the old red night vision that the military had in the red spectrum would pick up things that weren't there. They had complaints from soldiers from Vietnam that were using this new night vision and the Russians, the same thing, that would see things that aren't there, and they would collectively see the same thing. So they're like, uh-oh. And that's one of the reasons they went to the green spectrum, because it doesn't pick up the quote-unquote ghosts. And I wonder if some of these orbs and things may be natural, like the flora fauna kind of stuff that's just in the infrared and in the plasma, sort of not quite physical realm. Or, you know, some people think that that's a way that spirits get around, and how they manifest in our realm is the easiest form to take when they're traveling around is this orb shape. But I've seen points of light and things that flash and blink and move. So I don't know if I wouldn't think they're all the same quote unquote thing. I would think these are multiple quote unquote species, for lack of a better definition, of something that's existing within this other spectrum that's not quite physical.
Photonic entities, I believe that there are entities which are self-contained, intelligent, and made of light. When I grew up in the 50s, I always watched a program called Science Fiction Theater. And there's one episode about a scientist who's trying to replicate the atmosphere of Venus and exposing it to radiation similar to sunlight hitting Venus, and studying the possibility of life, germinating on planet Venus. But what happens is, it's not plant life. All of a sudden, these two luminosities appear inside the jar, and the luminosities are intelligent, and they grow stronger and stronger until they migrate out of the jar. But what they depicted in that science fiction theater looks like the stuff that's moving through your living room. Your kitchen seems to be the wormhole, or the opening, the door. They always start over there. What intrigues me is what trips the motion sensor, because the motion sensor turns on the camera before the things become visible. That's a fascinating thing. So,
well, I think there's some buffer. So it has it's got like a kind of like the way a police body cam works. Mm-hmm. So it buffers a certain point. And I think that it actually, it trips the motion sensor the moment motion is detected. So, yeah.
But the motion sensor, is the motion sensor tripped by sound? That's the key. No?
No. Only motion, and all the lights were off, so it's only tripped by infrared.
Yeah, so they have to be hot
fields.
Those things have to be warm for the infrared to pick them up in the first place. I had an interesting experience at the American Museum of Natural History. I went there for an exhibition, and when I arrived there, they had a demonstration of a FLIR camera, infrared camera that was rendering all the images according to their temperature. And I walked up, and everybody was a rosy pink color.
Thermal cams, yeah.
Yeah, thermal cam, that's what it was. Everybody was kind of like a yellowish to a pink color. I walked in, and I was white. And the technician said, I've never seen anything like that before. It's registering your skin temperature to be 122 degrees.
Yeah, I think they're picking something else up there.
it was picking up something, but I had run. I had been a little late for the show, or the opening of the show, so I'd run the last block to the entrance, and I'm wondering if that run had
been. It might have, yeah.
122 was pretty hot.
There are reports of people that have the self-driving Teslas, and I've seen a few videos where, like, they're parked in a cemetery. And they're looking, and the camera's picking up people that aren't there. And they're like, wait, wait, there's nobody there. Yeah, there was one where not only did the camera, well, there were two separate ones. One, the camera picked up some people in the cemetery that they couldn't see with the naked eye. And then another video, they could see people behind them, like, but the rear view camera didn't show the real people there. Wait a minute, those people aren't reflecting in the camera.
Yeah, but you could see them in the mirror.
You could see, well, they could see them with the naked eye. I don't know about the mirror, but they were,
they could see them with the naked eye, but not.
Yeah, why can't they see in the camera? So it was the inverse of, yeah, and then the other ones, the Tesla would see, visions of people in the cemetery that weren't there, which is kind of interesting. So maybe we're on the cusp of technology is becoming sophisticated enough to start to pick up things that previously went unnoticed because of our limitations in sensing.
Yeah. On a side note, since you mentioned electric car, Have we heard anything about the performance of electric cars during this blizzard? I'm curious to see what they did and how they performed compared to the internal combustion engine.
I don't think they performed very well at all. I really don't. I mean, there's technology that we haven't used that I think electric cars or that type of thing could actually be beneficial, but that technology is still classified. I mean, I worked at TRW Space and Defense, and we had something the size of a shoebox powered by a cube of silver, a sugar cube size of silver is the fuel. And that thing would power a city block for I don't know how long, but that technology exists. You know, there's these things that have been hidden with the patents, just like the 100 mile per gallon carburetor type stuff. So I think that even though they're trying to disrupt supply lines and take us off oil and everything else, they know that there is an alternative. Now, how fast that would take to set up the infrastructure, I don't know. But the current state of electric vehicles is not by any means prepared to take on any workload, I think, outside of like what, you know, little cars are doing now. And even that's not very efficient. Yeah. And the weight that you put on a Tesla truck, I mean, you have to recharge over and over, and it takes a lot to charge those things up. And the batteries to make those things, they have to create these big pools of poison, basically.
I'm totally against it. I'm a devotee of the internal combustion engine. It's really what raised humanity, you know, in the last century. Think about it. Think about what life was like without cars and airplanes and diesel. So we got to stop these maniacs.
Yeah, and it's all of our cars don't put out as much as one volcano eruption.
Yeah. About 10 years ago, I saw a demonstration of hydrogen fuel cell cars with the wheels on it, and there was the power supply. And it looked like a surfboard, and it said that they were going to be sealed, and you can't get into them. There's no maintenance, and it was going to be an R&R operation if it failed. You just went in, they slid out the surfboard with the wheels, and would slide another one in, but not much. But 2 weeks ago, I got news that the NIP, the National Ignition Project. It's a title which always bothers me.
Yeah.
the fusion project had some success. They concentrated some lasers on a particular type of gold and diamond, and they blasted it with a certain amount of energy, and they got one third more energy out of it than the investment.
All right, that's pretty much the end of this. There's about 10 minutes left. There's a link at revolution.radio. Anybody listening, make sure you come down to revolution.radio. Join in the chat room. Check out the schedules. Check out the archives and make a donation. Happy New Year to everybody out there. Happy New Year from revolution.radio. And Happy New Year to revolution.radio from myself. Have a great day and a great new year, everybody. Let's get ready to kick some liberal butts and take back the world. Ciao.
Revolution. Revolution.radio. FreedomSlips.com.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday.